This episode is brought to you by the Sexton Single Malt Irish Whiskey, the best-selling Irish single malt in the U.S. The Sexton is an unexpected modern malt for the everyman, rich in hue, approachable in taste, and memorable in character. Learn more at thesexton.com.
I'm HRN Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat in 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're focusing on water. You'll hear some disturbing news from an NYC investigative reporter.
Here lies the problem, how much we don't know about water tanks.
Katie Kiefer reports on water woes in the heartland.
Their water is heavily polluted with nitrates, which are coming from agricultural chemical applications on fields and running off into their water table.
And we'll check in with Dave Arnold, who's about to open a new bar that will serve some pretty fancy H2O.
It is hardcore.
So pour up a tall glass of ice water and be refreshed by this week's episode of Meat in 3, available on heritageradionetwork.org, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I interview someone who works behind the scenes in the food industry about their challenges and successes. Today, I'm speaking with an American who moved to Japan 30 years ago and has just written a comprehensive compendium of recipes from her adopted country. Listen in to hear stories of food, of love, of starting out as the resident bride in her in-laws' house and becoming an expert cooking teacher and student of both the land of grandmothers, of chefs, and more. Welcome, Nancy Singleton Hachisu.
Thank you, Dina.
So happy to have you here.
Yeah, me too.
So you were chosen by Fiden to write this gigantic collection of Japanese recipes. And I have to say, I wondered how that felt to you, because of course you've studied food all over Japan since you arrived in 1988, and you've taught cooking, but it just seems like a very daunting task.
Yeah, I mean, it was timing-wise, I was finishing up my second book, Preserving the Japanese Way, and I, of course, you know, knew about Fiden and respected them, and they were sort of the top, and to be asked and to be the person that was going to write the Japan book, and that they weren't considering asking anybody else, was very flattering. And
but did you have any like conflicts? Like, I'm not actually a Japanese person, though I'm married to a Japanese person, and I've lived here for, you know.
In that regard, no.
No, awesome. That never crossed your mind.
Never in a million years.
And that's because you know the culture better than anybody, and you're such a good translator of that culture?
No, I don't want to say that. It's because, you know, being Japanese is not the criteria for being able to write a Japanese cookbook, actually. Because not all Japanese can cook.
Yes.
So I'm sorry, but, you know, and not all Americans can cook. And not all Americans are the arbitrators of American food. And same thing with Japanese. And so, no, I do not know everything about Japanese cooking. You know, I don't. But I have a lot of access, and I have a lot of desire and passion. And so I didn't doubt I could write it. I knew it would be a huge project. And it was.
How many recipes are in the book?
Over 400. It was supposed to be at least 350, and I capped it mentally at 400. And I actually I think there's more than 400, but I was not going to give really more than 400 because that was the limit.
I love the mental numbers, what you stuck with, actually, regardless of what is truly in this book. I was interested in the way you talked about building relationships in order to make this book come to life. In America, the notion of, you know, building relationships over a year or 2 years in order to, you know, get a recipe from someone would, I think, be unimaginable. But can you talk about the Japanese notion of relationship building?
Yeah, actually, that was the hardest part because, first of all, if you introduce somebody, so if I introduce you to somebody I am 100% responsible for you and for everything you do going forward.
That sounds like a lot.
Yeah. And so I really try to, and so for my introductions are not given lightly. And it's been hard over the years sometimes.
I bet. You're like, you know, I like you, but not enough to vouch for you for the next 10 years.
And then you have to control them. And some people, foreigners, when I talk about foreigners, I mean non-Japanese, even you explain it many times, they still don't really understand and they still screw it up in some way. And it becomes a bit of a problem. And, you know, actually, truly, the Japanese are so forgiving in this way. And so it's more...
Forgiving in what way?
Well, so somebody, you know, acts badly a little bit or not, doesn't, you know, follow the culture as I've asked them to do. And I feel badly or embarrassed for that bad act, you know, and that, but the Japanese are very forgiving, you know, about that. And so it's more, I feel badly.
Did you have to cultivate patience, you know, coming from the States in order to, you know, adopt this sort of point of view?
Absolutely. And I've been there for 30 years. And so it was really a work in progress. And I grew up in a family of six. You know, my parents were kind of beatniky intellectuals, and so yelling was our form of communication. Uh-huh. And I think that's probably what attracted me about Japan. And I wasn't specifically going there looking for a lifestyle change by any means, but I knew there was something about Japan and Japanese culture that was very compelling and maybe something that I needed to adopt in some way. And right off the bat when I went there, and I went there because I wanted to learn Japanese and I love sushi and I was going to go to graduate school, but did not. I, of course, like many of us, was very interested in Zen.
But, yeah.
And I wanted to go practice Zen, you know, because I guess I did really want that, a little bit more quiet in my life and stop being the yeller. Americans like to argue a lot. Have you noticed that?
And I hate to argue. So yes, I've noticed
that. I hate to argue too now, but before I was just one of the arguers, but nobody practices Zen. This is like not a thing.
Really?
I mean, should I say nobody? I mean, of course somebody's practicing Zen, but it was not, you know, the thing people do in everyday life. And they call it Zazen, not Zen. And so there was some communication difficulties. I did do it a few times at this Zen temple. And then I was like, I'm just pretending to do this. This is ridiculous. And I never prayed at a temple again because I thought it was just like pretending to pray, you know?
Right.
So, and I don't know about where we got to that, but, no, I slowly acquired, understanding and knowledge of the customs. And I also, like, there's this big gift giving thing, and I don't give perfunctory gifts. I would give homemade gifts rather than those days when I was first there. You commonly would get soap and detergent, these weird boxes, things that, and it's not the soap or detergent I would ever use. Right. And so I didn't know.
That's very unusual. I guess it's practical.
Practical. Yeah. There's gift giving seasons.
Right.
And
I didn't know there's a soap season.
There was a great one of my first was there too. That was blankets or towel blankets. They're really cool.
Oh, I love that.
I got that from, when we did the house renovation, I got them from my mother-in-law. She still had them in boxes.
Oh my goodness.
But anyway, yeah, I just.
Talking about Zen makes me think of one of the two people you relied on, upon quite a bit in putting together this book, and that is a nun.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about connecting with her and her point of view on recipes and how you brought that forth?
Harumi Kawaguchi, she was doing, I met her, 2008, I guess. She was doing a little Shojin Ryori restaurant, that's temple food cooking, at our local soy sauce company up in the hills. And they had a small house near the place, she could only come twice a month, and we ate there occasionally, and it was only two seatings, and it was just her food was so clear and beautiful. And you know, with chefs or good cooks, you eat their food and you know them as a person
yes.
through their food, right? And so she just was such a beautiful person. Her food was so beautiful, and she had all those sensibilities that I love, that, you know, that's similar to like Alice Waters or those people that, you know, that's the kind of food that I want to eat. And it's not the food that I cooked, and she was using the local ingredients. And then we invited her to, I was quite involved in slow food at the time. I had my own convivium group, and we had a thing at my house, and I invited her to come. And she came, and then a few months later, we got this, and she's a handwritten letter person.
Oh,
we
lovely.
Got this letter, and of course, I can't read it, you know, because I'm a very lazy Japanese reader. And then, she said she had been so inspired by our passion about food, because she actually was living in the city at the time. And so,
and you live in rural Japan.
Yeah, and so she was so inspired by our passion about food, and so she went back into the nunnery to do more food, because there's an element of, I don't quite understand it, you know, for me it's on need to know basis, you know. I have not gotten to find out that information, but in the nunneries or the monasteries there's an element of food in the Zen religion, you know. So she went back in to do more about food.
Wow.
Right?
You sent her to a nunnery? Amazing. And then she came out to gave you some recipes.
Right. So I went to visit her. I was thinking to put a little section of Shoji Norii in the book. And I ran into her. And I had looked for her. I couldn't find her on the internet because she's not internet focused. And finally, I ran into her a few years ago at this ceremony at Meiji Jingu, where the guy cuts down the carp. Have you heard of this? And don't touch the fish. And he's from the Shijo family, from Shijo Dori in Kyoto, 34th generation.
Wow.
Amazing people. Yeah. And I reconnected with her. I was so excited to see her. And then 2 years later, I think we're talking 2015, in January, in the beginning of the book project, or it might have been 2016, you know, years they go by, maybe 2016. And I asked her, it was really hard to ask, like, I'm writing a book and I want to write a Shoji Norii book next. And I, again, it's the asking thing, you know, so, and I don't know the situation. I wanted to go visit her and have her cook Shoji Norii that I could taste and maybe see her do it. So hard to ask. And so I did. And
it's hard to ask because you don't want to put someone on the spot.
Also, I didn't know the situation so well.
Yeah.
You know, as it turns out, she doesn't cook Shoji Norii every day.
Uh-huh.
they eat regular old Japanese food, mm-hmm. and it's a very... She cooks for two temples.
Wow.
And there's only a couple priests in residence. And so... and she doesn't live at the temples. I bet she has her own place because the priests live there. And, sorry, I'm a little... tickle in my throat. And she invited me to stay at her house. She sent me this fax about what's happening with the temple situation. We set the date, but then she sent me where the temples are, what was the situation, and that I could stay at her house, and that she would make a meal. And I did not realize she was making it only for me.
Oh my goodness.
And it's very, it's a prescribed cooking, and there's, you know, maybe 12, 15 dishes. And she made each one only for me.
That's so beautiful,
though. I know.
That's so, so special.
Oh, my God. And so, and she served it to me in this special room facing the garden. And I was moved and kind of like, oh, my God, I asked her this huge thing. And then, and I, you know, we spent a lot of time together over the two days. And I asked her about, you know, my future project of doing the book and coming back for each season, bringing the photographer. We did come with a photographer, and she was really excited actually to have her food in another book. She had written a Shoji Norii book, and we have it. But then the long story of it, she handed me this book on my way out of town. And it is a book she had written before becoming a nun.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
How old was she when she became a nun?
I don't know.
Well, whatever.
Yeah.
So so she had written a book, and then...
And it was Kenko Ryori, so healthy food. Mm. And I handed it to my son. I saved it around, I was looking at it, and I just, you know, lazy Japanese writer, reader, whatever, reader, writer. And I gave it to my son who was in between jobs and living, he lives at home, which many Japanese kids do, and asked him to mark, and he has a really great palate, and I asked him to mark anything that was delicious, came back with 100 marks in it.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, right, and so, and it's like a 280 recipe book, or 260 recipes, and then I had my assistant record it, and I started transcribing the recipes, but I think you'll really appreciate this. They weren't recipes per se. They were listing of ingredients, no proportions.
Oh my goodness.
Golden, right? Golden. And then Elizabeth David-y style of method. And
so, little descriptions.
So I could, and I asked her, could I use some of this material? And she says, yes. And so I could channel her. I really tried to make the flavor as I felt like she would. It was not a Nancy Hachisu book. And, but then, you know, of course, it can't take me out of the equation. And
it's through your palate.
Yeah, exactly.
And your precision, because having no, I mean, that's very little to start with, but at least you have the ingredients.
Right, right. And so I transcribed the whole book, and then I made recipes. I selected the ones that were going to go in the book, and then I sat at the computer and just made the recipes as I thought, right? And then I tested them all, and they were 80% perfect as written. So that was one skill I have.
Well, you have
one of
a few. I think confidence is also a skill to know that you can do this. You know, which is not everybody has that one.
Right, right.
I was fascinated by the fact that you tried to get grandmothers to give you recipes. So you had great luck with a nun, which would not be the first place I would think that that person's going to, you know, either have 200 or whatever recipes to share, nor that she would be necessarily so much of this world that that would be a great resource, particularly since she was doing temple cuisine. But when you go to the grandmothers, who I would think, oh, grandmothers are always the source of great recipes,
yeah.
And particularly in Japan when you were doing, I mean, you describe it as a framework to understand Japanese cuisine rather than, you know, like, this is what it is.
Yeah.
But the grandmothers were not very helpful.
Well, you know, I started out the first... I knew it was going to be a huge project, and so I started working right away before I even had a contract inked. And I started by separating out the country of where I had chef contacts that I admired, and we had the same ideas about food, and they were, you know, used local ingredients, and some of them were Frenchy Japanese chefs, or some of them were Italian Japanese, and that was, and then they also knew the local people. And I knew I would have to travel at least 2 to 3 times last time with the photographer. And I started along that way. And the first place I went was where this Teiko Watanabe ended up. She was a well-known cook grandmother that had events. You see.
Gotta love a grandmother with events.
Yeah, right? And it was events through this chef I know and these iron pot iron kettle people.
Oh, right. You said the ironworks was the connection to her.
And, you know, I have loads of footage and tapage and notage, but, and she's not necessarily my perfect style of cooking, but she was a really good cook.
Right.
I knew that. And so, and this is, again, not a Nancy Hachisu book. It's all of the food that was delicious I wanted to put in the book. That was the criteria. And delicious and authentic. And but speed up another year, and I had all that material. I went twice to these events. And that in that case, you can get a framework for a recipe, and then I could ask her to check, you know. But I was looking through. By then, I knew I was using this sort of 70s, 80s material. I was going to be drawing from written material because, yes, the grandmas were lovely and we sat together. And some places they did cook for me, but it was, you know, maybe not the most delicious. And but, you know, it's more like, oh, yeah, this is, we take this and we make this and we make this and we make this. But we make them at New Year.
Or we make it so specific.
Obon, this is the summertime. And then how could I say, well, I'm going to come back here 2 months from now, and are you going to cook for me all day? Well, who can ask such a thing?
Right. No.
So, but I discovered that I, of the one other Japanese cookbook besides the Kawaguchi-san's book that I liked and that Andrew liked.
That's your son.
my taste arbiter son was one that this cooking teacher, 80-year-old cooking teacher had written too.
Amazing. So why 70s and 80s?
Well, because that was the material that I found best.
But why do you think it was best?
Oh, well, because those are the bubble years. Oh, look at it. The 40s, they still didn't have food.
Right.
Really. 50s, finally, there was actual food, mm-hmm. you know, and because the war had decimated Japan. Mm-hmm. And then 70s, the food, I mean, leisure, the 70s, 80s were a really affluent time, you know, and the women had leisure. Now, many women, probably a majority of women work.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's not a majority, but even the grandmothers of the kids in my little, I have a little preschool, they've worked, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so working means less cooking.
Right.
And less passing on. And then, but so 70s and 80s was still a time of, okay, it was affluence. Food was better, mm-hmm. frankly. There's a lot of sesame in this. The raw materials were better. The vegetables were better. There's resurgence now because of what people see is happening and the back to nature people and the sort of semi-hippie movement and the stuff coming from abroad of focusing on food, how much food focuses. But anyway.
So do you think that the 90s and the 90s and the 00s were just like a downslope?
Totally, yeah.
Wow.
I arrived in 88, one of the first...
Oh my God, you arrived just at the wrong time.
Yeah. Right, I was really surprised by the mixture of home cooking at a gathering and takeout.
Uh-huh.
Whether it's a bento takeout or Kentucky Fried Chicken...
Ooh.
Yeah, it was an idea that...
That would burn a slow food lady's heart.
Oh, my God. I was really shocked at what could I say, you know? I had only had Kentucky Fried Chicken, I think, once in my life in childhood with some friends' family, you know?
Understandable.
The mixture. And I would ask them, like, you know, your home cooking is so good. Why do you order these prefab bentos to these things? And they'd say, oh, well, you know, it's better for the guests that we have these. And it's partially lack of confidence,
uh-huh.
which is, I think, undermines many people for cooking. And that's, I think, the trouble now in Japan is like, oh, I can't. You see it on TV, the perfect omelet, the perfect this, the perfect that. And it's worldwide.
Yes, I agree. It's worldwide.
Yeah.
Confidence and also lack of interest and many other options.
Right.
Right.
So
and then diversity. Like you might be, if you're a home cook, you might be great at a chicken and some green beans. And, what you know, you have your world of food and you want to step outside of it.
Yeah. You know, but I've been reading and cooking from cookbooks since I was like 10. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's how I learned to cook. And so, yeah, I have... I don't know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cookbooks. I don't use them so much anymore because I'm really focused on writing books I've been cooking so much that I'm cooking really simply now, you know. Frankly, tuna fish sandwich at night sounds really good, but
I think that's the evolution.
Yeah,
you know.
Right. My 30s and 40s, major, you know, 20s, but
now you're on to tuna fish. It's good to know.
Nothing wrong with tuna fish.
Yeah.
But so that's a big message in my books. And also I do media in Japan. I'm fortunate to be a long-term foreigner who really values Japanese food culture. And I also don't gloss it up. I mean, I tell it how it is. There's good and the bad. And I think that's really important because if you say everybody in Japan is eating seasonally, that's just bullshit, you know? And if you say that, then you're stopping the ability for this to come back.
Right.
You know?
And as you said, I think there's also the global movement to embrace embrace the seasons, embrace the farms, and certainly with the book you've created and your past books, there's so much emphasis on vegetables, and there's so much
right. There's
incredible,
a lot of vegetables in this.
A lot of vegetables in this.
Yeah, me too.
I want to ask one question, then we're going to take a quick break. So much of the food in this book and so much of Japanese cooking is based on having access to spectacular ingredients. And that is everything from, there's a lot of aubergine / eggplant in the book, or sesame seeds. The things where I trip up just as the basics of cooking Japanese food at home, which I like to try to do, is the mirin, the quality of the soy, mm-hmm. The quality of the rice vinegar.
Absolutely.
I find that I have access to the most commercialized versions, which mean that they're quite sweet or they're not very subtle.
Yep.
And I was hoping to get from you recommendations of either sources, which would be the best places to find brand names, just for so that listeners can really sort of achieve the closest thing mm-hmm. to the Japanese cooking that they can in America. Because if you have that foundation, it's a good place to start.
Yeah. So my first recommendation is avoid the Asian groceries and go for the health food stores.
First, that's
number
huge.
One. Huge. Yeah.
Wow.
Because,
why is that?
Because the Asian grocery stores products came over and they were poor quality and never have got, and then they have not gotten out of that poor quality paradigm. That's not across the board, but that's a generalization. Whereas the 70s macrobiotic movement brought over the better products. And there's, who's the guy in Boston? There's Osawa, and then there's that other guy, and I've just totally spaced it out. So that's number one. And it Whole Foods, I think you can go for Eden.
Okay.
And they do a good job. The Japanese Pantry in San Francisco, they got an online site. I'm a big fan of online shopping, frankly, because I don't like to drive. But and I just don't like to waste time. But the Japanese Pantry is...
That's a great source, then.
A really great source. It has the most fabulous sesame products in the whole world. Wataman. Yes, it's expensive. The oil is like ambrosial. You can drink it like lovely olive oil. You'll go crazy.
I'm so ready. Like my fingers are
they're
are twitching.
I have some in my bag.
Oh, wow.
And the seeds, the seeds here are rancid or cracked or just horrible. Soy sauce, our local soy sauce is repackaged by Goldmine in another online source. And Goldmine in San Diego has a whole gamut of Osawa products. Again, well made. Mitoku is selling the meeting mirin that I use, Mikawa meeting, best in the world. Of course, there's other small ones, but best available meeting.
It is about what's available, right? Because I find Roland, and I'm like, this isn't helping my food.
Yeah, exactly. And, frankly, that was bought. I asked Daniel Gritzer to buy it on Amazon. I found it and said, go buy this because I can't bring any bottles and I'm getting all the bottle stuff when I get to San Francisco. And so the Nama Shoyu that Goldmine repackages, it's got a yellow ochre label and script, widely available. The guys doing, and that's our local soy sauce.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Rice vinegar.
Yes.
Please do not use the ones that start with M.
Okay.
Am I allowed to say the name?
Yeah, do you think...
Yeah, meets spacing out.
But it starts with an M, people.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Mitoku. No, not Mitoku. It's the ones that are in everybody's closet.
It's like M-A-K.
Okay.
Well, we don't know.
Yeah.
But you guys out there, you probably know. Just right, don't get that
right,
one.
Don't get that one, yeah. It's made from ethyl alcohol and, just horrible stuff. Iyo Jozo is the vinegar I use. It's available through Japanese Pantry. Otherwise, Eden does a really good job in they get Japanese products and put them into their bottles. They've got a brown rice vinegar. I don't know if they've got a white rice, maybe.
I was interested that brown rice isn't popular at all.
No.
In Japan, it's like a tiny,
yeah.
tiny portion. I think Americans aren't so interested in brown rice per se.
I prefer it myself.
You do? You like the
flavor? I like the texture. Yeah.
The texture. Okay, we're going to... I had to know that because... I feel like that unlocks everything.
So get those products.
And get those products.
And substitute for Japanese vegetables that you don't have. Right. Substitute what you have locally.
There's something that is like fasolati dough that's actually susam.
No. You know, I've loved it in two interviews already. Wait. It's a I u e o is the vowels. And then sa shi su se so. Is the acronym.
And what does that stand
mnemonic,
for?
Mnemonic. It's the flavors in Japanese cuisine. Sa means sato, sugar. And in this case, it's, I probably can't remember, it's meeting for me. Sa, shi is salt, shio, salt. Sa, shi, su, thank you. Su is vinegar. Sa, shi, su, se, salt, se. Seju is the old word for soy sauce, and so is miso.
So I love that, because if you can remember sugar or mirin, salt or shio, su or vinegar, sio or soy sauce, and so for miso, you actually have the foundations, sweet, salty, umami.
Right.
And that way you... That's the foundation of so many dishes. When I look at the ingredients, did you come up with that,
or
is that something the school children learn?
No, yeah. And that's why I flub it. it's part of Japanese cooking.
It's foundational. Yes, okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about what it is like to be an American. Living in Japan, married to an organic farmer, and that lifestyle. Okay. Stay with us.
I'm Souther Teague of Moria Margo and co-host of The Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. This episode is brought to you by the Sexton Single Malt Irish Whiskey, a new and unexpected modern malt for the everyman. The whiskey is made from 100% Irish malted barley, triple distilled for smoothness in copper pot stills, and consciously aged for 4 years in Oloroso sherry butts. My favorite part about the Sexton is that sherry influence from those Oloroso sherry butts. They're the large sherry barrels that have been used. And then the whiskey gets aged in them for 4 years, giving them this sort of nutty, almost savory quality. The copper pot still makes for an extremely smooth finish. I like it in a highball or just neat. Every time I have a sip, I want another one. So next time you're gathered with friends or posted up at your favorite bar, reach for the Sexton, the best-selling Irish single malt in North America. You can learn more at thesexton.com.
Welcome back. You are listening to Dana Cowan, and this episode of Speaking Broadly, I have as my guest Nancy Singleton Hachiso. I'm so excited to hear about your life in Japan. When I was at Food and Wine, we came to visit you because that lifestyle seemed so exceptional. Mm-hmm. You know, dreamy, I think, puts too soft a filter on it because,
in fact,
it's a lot of work.
Well, you know, yes and no. We chose to sort of not do our life in the traditional way because it is a lot of work. And in fact, farmers can't find wives.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's very sad.
Yeah, because no Japanese girl wants to be a wife of a farmer because it's a lot of work.
So an American girl is like, yeah, I can handle it because
I don't know.
That's right.
And because we have weeds in the field and because we're not perfect people. And, you know, as time goes by, though, my husband becomes more traditional. So, yeah.
That's interesting. Is that a surprise?
No. I mean, it's a little bit hard to deal with. But I've become more non-confrontational. Like, I don't like to argue and things like that. But, He enjoys it because he learned it from me. Where did I start?
There's an interesting cultural exchange there.
Right.
So I know that in the early years of your marriage and when you had your three boys, your husband was working. I mean, he had to work the seasons because that's what one does. And he really never left the farmers. That's what it sounded like.
Yeah, actually, when we were first sort of negotiating this, you know, marriage, of course, I'm the American, I'm like a contract. Okay, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do this. And it has not all, I've gone back on most of them, actually. But, and he famously tells stories about that. But one of the things I asked is like about leisure. And I said, do you never take a day off, like to just sit and read your book or something? And he says, no, never. Like, oh my God. Well, so if I do that, am I going to be the lazy American? You know, and actually it's turned out that I don't do that either. Like I can't sit. I want to do my work. I wait for my day off so that I can, because I have a little school, you know, but I never am not working, and we don't really socialize except for I have, you know, dinner parties for Thanksgiving, Christmas, and maybe one other time. I find this lifestyle actually really comfortable. And so my social life is in when I've traveled. That's it. But
and what is it like to immerse yourself so completely in a culture that is radically different? You know, well, where leisure isn't a value, which I feel like that is the primary American value. Like you work hard so you can play.
Right, right.
Whatever
right.
that is, you know, right. soccer, swim, I don't know.
Right. Well, I guess I work hard and I'm very compartmentalized. When I work on something, I'm only working on that. And so I like working. And then when I come to the States, it's like partially work, partially social, you know, it's you can't separate it. But I feel like we picked and chose the pieces of the culture, and that's what made it. And like my lifestyle now is very similar to how I grew up. Like we have I grew up in a modern house that was actually built with many modern Japanese sensibilities, and I didn't really realize that at the time. There was a courtyard in the middle. It was all oiled redwood and glass doors all around the whole house. But it was sort of a messy lifestyle, an actual messy house with six kids, and a similar thing, messy lifestyle, maybe dusty house. But, you know, we homeschooled, we do our sorts of odd things. And luckily, I mean, maybe that's why my husband and I came together, is we both had unconventional ideas and we made our lifestyle. And he had traveled abroad. He had lived in Brazil and he had traveled to North Korea and a foreign mission and China. And he was an out-of-the-box thinker. And maybe that's why he married me, because I made him more normal.
Yes, I think by comparison, he's probably... And you did spend a bit of time traveling every year, taking the kids.
Yeah.
Do they feel the pull of the States? Or they? I know one son is living with you, but
yeah. So the funny thing is, they all at the sort of end of teenager time. They, oh, my mother dragged me around the world. Poor me. You know? And then like when they get together with the oldest son and the youngest son came here for college, and then they find out that actually this is a super cool thing to do. Oh, it wasn't so bad after all. But one came to college here and went back to Japan, has a Japanese wife that he met in America.
Oh my goodness.
And his baby. And then the other one's at UMass Amherst, and he has announced that he's never going to live in Japan again. You know, maybe London. He did an internship there. But the oldest son, he has an intention of perhaps coming here for a few years. And then the middle son, he was just in New York for 2.5 weeks, and he said he got homesick after about 10 days. Really? So I don't know. We homeschooled them so they would feel deeply Japanese, because my husband's is traditional but modern. And then also traveled with them so they would have a connection with America and feel comfortable here and be bicultural.
You live with your in-laws. I mean, you renovated the house.
Yeah, we lived.
Lived.
They're no longer with us.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
But I know that people thought that your mother-in-law had taught you to cook.
Yes, who repeats these stories? I never wrote that, actually. It's so funny.
It is funny. Is it because mother-in-laws traditionally in Japan teach their daughters-in-law to cook? Is that a thing?
It's also because in Japanese farm food, my mother-in-law, I wrote the book with her still alive. And then she died the time of handing in. And I didn't want to rewrite it in the past tense.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I put a little picture of her and since I think it was Remembering Bachchan. And I think that people don't read very well.
Yes, they look at the pictures.
Very closely.
They saw the picture and they're like,
yeah.
Wow.
And also, yes, it's a lovely idea to think of. And a few people have said it. And the thing about the internet, it never goes away.
That's true. It just keeps coming back.
Yeah, so I try to correct that. But yeah, I had always wanted to write cookbooks because I learned from cookbooks and I like to write. And so when I was, when I was ready to do this, I wanted to write a cookbook about like the food that my husband cooked, mm-hmm. and that actually I was more of an assistant. I was not the main Japanese cook because I was cooking all the other countries' food. I was way into confit and I was making my own sausages, but chorizo, you know. And I only liked a few people's Japanese food. I liked the men's food.
How does the men's food differ from the women's food?
Well, typically men, older women tend not to drink, mm-hmm. and so it matches tea mm-hmm. as opposed to sake or beer. And there's just the older women's food, a lot of them was very sweet, like really sweet. And that sugar's kind of a new ingredient in Japan,
right?
You know, so, and not particularly to my taste, but I have learned that. You know, like with really good mirin, if I use a proportion of 2 soy sauce or 2 miso to 1 part mirin, and mm-hmm. the mirin, if they're equally well made and equally mm-hmm. flavorful, the mirin just mitigates the salt and makes it into this beautiful fusion. So it's sort of the perfect togetherness. And
it sounds like your marriage. That's great. 2 different sides, you know, round each other out.
Right. So I would say to my husband, okay, I'm going to make nikujaga, which is a really standard dish. And I just wasn't, you know, he's making it. I'm not so interested. We're busy, you know. So he'd say, okay, he'd just take his hand. And I'd be catching him on the fly because he had a free-range egg business and okay, in motion with this much meat, this much onion, and this much shirataki, and then the noodles, and then glug glug soy sauce, and some ginger, and some sake, and done, or something like that. And so I would get all my ingredients out, and then I'd make it, I would remember what he said, and then make it how I felt as well, because And then I would measure it afterwards, how much had I put in. I had to, of course, taste it. And that's how I wrote the recipe. But then I evolved into just writing the recipe out of my head. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, recipes, they have to be logical. And
yes.
And so much of you can taste food without actually tasting it. In some, you know, I think that's as you go along and are experienced. And so that's how it sort of segued into. But basically,
when do men learn to cook? Because you said he was an excellent cook. I mean, is that something that, like, do Japanese boys, you know, get taught by somebody?
Depends on the family. So, farming families,
yes,
the parents work and mm-hmm. the grandparents take care of the children. Mm-hmm. And so, his grandmother was a really good cook. His mother was never had the true love of cooking, mm-hmm. and apparently, she was very good at pickling and preserving. But I missed the window on that, so I culled that sort of techniques from my local friends. But anyway, there was 3 boys in the family, no girls, uh-huh. and so the kids were taught to cook and clean by the grandmother, and she was an excellent cook, and she also the grandparents had great sensibilities about the, you know, about the stuff they had in the house, and the grandmother. Made her own cloth, her own really amazing designs, silk, beautiful colors, you can't imagine. And his mother did too, but she had a less of a sense.
And your husband also makes pottery, right?
So yeah. He's very artistic, yes. And so do all the sons, but the 2 younger ones have let it go. My oldest son continues. And
a beautiful tradition. Mm-hmm. When you were living in, you know, rural Japan rather than Tokyo, did anything about that pace of life, did it seem more old-fashioned, more other than it would have Do you feel if you were in a city?
No, I'm not really. I mean, I did live in San Francisco for 8 years after college, and but I grew up on a woodsy lot.
So it wasn't.
And I would never marry a salaryman and live in Tokyo. Please kill me first. No.
One of the things that you said in a piece, I think it was actually for Food and Wine, was how over time, you had your ideals about what you wanted to do and mm-hmm. how you were working in the time you had sort of segmented off to do your own work. Mm-hmm. But over time, you became more drawn to the farm, and one of your goals was to be closer to thinking and acting in the way that your husband did, which I thought was fascinating, because one could evolve in all kinds of directions. You could mm-hmm. evolve and say, I'd actually like to travel 6 months of the year.
Yeah.
But in fact, somehow being of this place made you want to be more of this place. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, how do you think that came about?
Well, I think that growing up in a sort of loosey-goosey family, we were allowed to sort of do what we wanted in some way, and so I didn't have a lot of self-discipline. And although I managed to, get to a good college, I still had really poor habits. And so, and the strength of character that it takes to do what my husband does was so remarkable, and he so unflinchingly is so, and sometimes it's really irritating, frankly, because he's so perfect. But he's not perfect. But I wanted to be. I didn't want to be a flaky 20s. I didn't. Mm-hmm. I wanted to push myself and not just say, "Oh, I want the vegetables," and I'm, you go off and do it. I just felt like it was important to keep pushing yourself, even though you can't do it perfectly. And that's a big message. I feel that you need to forgive yourself. And I haven't been able to, and part of traveling, which, gets in the way of planting or of harvesting, and I haven't really truly gone to the field since I started writing books, because, I go pick something, but I cannot grow something because I'm not, or sometimes the deadlines, when you have writing deadlines, and this is not something that my husband actually can understand, because it's not a, that's not a relevant part of our life. Like, if you have to do this, you need to do that. And that's the same thing with Japanese life, that people will come by and, I'll hide. But that if somebody comes by, you have to be, you drop everything. And they do. And you just, you have all the time in your world, and you don't have this deadline that something's due at 5 o'clock, and if you don't get it in, you're going to be in really trouble.
I
can't be busy.
I know you had said that in households, someone stays home.
Right.
So that they can receive guests if they happen to come over. That seems extremely inconvenient to me.
Right. Well, we don't actually do that anymore, but our house is always unlocked.
So someone could stop by if they chose to.
Right. But, that's a part of the beautiful things about Japanese life and about Japanese culture.
And what do you think when people come to visit and they have this expectation in their mind, because you've described it and you've written about it, and what do you think the biggest surprise to them is when they come and actually, exist in your life and landscape?
My friend Sylvan Brackett, the first time he came, he had Rintaro in San Francisco, and he was working at Japanese, and then he was starting his catering business. He came to and he goes, "Oh, Nancy." I mean, in those days, I really was a lot on the field, and he's like, "Oh," he thinks of me as like an Atherton girl that, by the way, is like a gentlewoman farmer, and no, I'm not a farmer. Please get this record straight. He goes, "Oh, Nancy, you really are a farmer, I was not really, but he was surprised at the actual rusticness of the whole thing. It's more like people think I'm still living the Japanese farm food life, which was part of our life, but
the book that you wrote.
Right. And then the preserving. I'm not Sandra Katz. Sandra Katz came to visit us, and he is a master fermenter, and that is his whole, that's not the sum total of what he is, but people come and people write me and they want to come work on the farm. Like, how? Why? You know, we don't sell vegetables. We just have some vegetables in the field. And that's my husband's thing, and he does not want to take care of you. Or they want to help me with my preserving or my pickling. Like, how? You know, I mean, what? And so, yes.
Impractical expectations of how they could contribute or be part of this life that just seems so dreamy.
And so, yes, there's a bunch of really cool pickles in this book, but I was very busy with this book. And so that was my life for 2 years. And so actually haven't had a chance to do umeboshi because I was in New York both Junes, you know, recently, or I was...
Which is plums. It's quite the process to make that perfect plum.
Well,
you dry it, salt it, rehydrate it.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's not that. I mean, there's just, it's a possibility of I like to keep the salt down, and that's what, you know, and I recently was talking to the ume guy, the sour plum, so-called sour plum guy, about they use lots more salt, and they somehow regulate that. I still don't quite understand how it could, but it can mold on top when it's brining, and that it's not actually that hard, but there is some, you know, little pitfalls. But also, it's the most important thing is picking it at the very right moment. Mm-hmm. And every time I ask my husband, are the ume ready? And he'd say, why don't you go check it? It's like, well, I kind of don't really understand when they're ready.
Right.
Because and I think the problem for Americans, I get feedback, oh, my brine didn't come up. It's probably because their ume is being sold in the shops are underripe. So they're green, and they're underripe, 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 and then there's like one day before they fall or before they turn, and that's the one day you do the umeboshi. So I'm still girl who can't ripe.
That's a very small window.
Exactly.
Yes.
And are you busy that day? Yes.
So no umeboshi.
Yeah.
And when you look ahead, because this has been such a big project, are there projects you have on the horizon that you're excited to undertake?
Oh, yeah. Well, in my travels, there was a huge portion of the photos and travel material and notes and that I that did not get into this book. There was some refocusing of the book, and that will go into Food Artisans of Japan book. That's going to come out with Hardy Grant, coming out 2019 fall.
Oh, fantastic. So you kind of got two for the price of one one time, although I guess it doesn't actually really work that way.
So it was a win-win in a little bit of a troubling situation. And this book is, you know, the better for that.
The reshaping.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And when you look to America... And I don't know how familiar you are with the food scene. Obviously, you have some very deep-shaped Panese connections. But is there someone who, in America or even around the globe, who inspires you, a woman in the world that we inhabit that you want to pay forward? I always like to end the show on paying forward to an inspiration.
There's nobody else like Alice Waters. She must be the dearest, most hardest worker in the whole world, and God thank her.
What do you think that she's done that nobody else has been able to do?
She's changed the whole world of food. And I don't think people give her enough credit for that. I mean, a lot of people pay lip service, but she really has. And then that fight for the edible schoolyard, damn, she never stops. I mean, that is just awe-inspiring. I mean, I feel like she's like Tadaki, my husband, and that I feel like so inadequate compared to that, you know, and it's just, I mean, I'm tired. And she keeps going. So passionate. I mean, just like, it's really, you know, I'm crying, actually. But well, really.
Yeah, Alice has indeed changed the world and inspired so many people.
Right.
You know, and she is...
Drives some people crazy, but...
the Energizer Bunny of the food movement with such purity of point of view. Really unshiftable from what
absolutely
I can see.
Uncompromising about ideals.
And it could have turned out a different way, but the way it turned out is everyone conformed, not everyone, but we conformed to her ideals about food culture.
Also, she's the most generous person that could ever live. Kindest, most generous, most, you know, warm person.
So with that, we're going to conclude this episode of Speaking Broadly. Nancy, thank you so much. If people want to find you on, what's your preferred medium? Twitter, Instagram?
I post on Instagram at Nancy Hachisu, and then I zip it over to Twitter and Facebook. So I look at all of them. I have a program that tells me about the mentions.
Awesome. Yeah. So if you want to reach her, that's where you can find her. And you know where to find me at FW Scout on Twitter and Instagram. Always look forward to hearing from you. Thank you, Carlin Thompson, for being with me today as my able social aid. And thank you to Fiden. We're in their offices today with an extraordinary view. Everybody, thank you so much for joining us, and see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please, join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.